This week on Pirate Party Radio, private medical information stored on digital photocopiers sold to the general public. Courts allow collection of names in anonymous fair use cases for the RIAA. And Canadian government proposed to bring the US-style DMCA and RFID passports. This is Pirate Party Radio, episode 27, for Thursday, May 6, 2010.
Nearly every digital copier built since 2002 contains one of these, a hard drive. Like the one on your personal computer, it stores an image of every document scanned, copied, or emailed by the machine. But it wasn't until we hit print on the fourth machine from a New York insurance company that we obtained the most disturbing documents. 300 pages of individual medical records, everything from drug prescriptions to blood test results to a cancer diagnosis, a potentially serious breach of federal privacy law.
On the one hand, I can say you're all screwed. You are all totally screwed because everything is going onto the internet. You're just screwed. I mean, the amount of information that is being collected on everything that is done, and it's just impossible to work and communicate in a normal way unless you have technical specialists dedicated to do this for you, means that your information trails and your sources' information trails are just everywhere.
We are under siege. They are doing everything they can to prevent progress, to prevent the spread of culture, and to prevent privacy as we know it. The only way to stop this is to unite. This is definitely a global movement. It's continuing to spread across the world like wildfire. We are seeing the birth of a new global political power. There's no way to control the information. There's no way to control culture, control knowledge. And those who control culture and knowledge control the world. And that is losing its last compass. People don't understand how big this really is.
I'm James O'Brien, and welcome to Pirate Party Radio, the official show of the Pirate Party of Canada and the U.S., your source for news around the world on copyright, net neutrality, open government, free culture and speech, patents, privacy, and more. Make sure you check out the Pirate Party Radio forums for the links to all the news stories mentioned during the show. And off the top of this show, we had some intro clips, one from Copy Machines, a security risk. It was a YouTube clip from a CBS show, sent in by Random Hero, and Icelandic Free Press Haven, sent in by DC, where they talk on 4ATV discussing Icelandic... setting up an Icelandic kind of free speech haven where reporters can store their data and report in the press things that they don't aren't normally allowed to in their own countries because of certain laws. And we've got some incoming messages. This is from Semaphore, this little brother by Cory Doctorow. I recently finished this book and thought it might be good to let others know. I just recently finished this book and thought it might be good to let others who may not have read it know. It's an amazing piece that should be read by all interested in modern and near future security and personal freedom matters. It's available for free from the website below. And there's also five Canadian schools looking for copies. See the donate link for more information, because you're able to go to the website and donate this book by, I guess, donating money and allowing the book to go to certain schools that have requested the book. That's a very interesting way of doing things. And some supplementary information: last year, Little Brother was adapted for the stage and may one day make it as a major motion picture. So very interesting link there from Semaphore. Thank you very much. And if you'd like to contact me, ask a question, or leave a comment, head over to Pirate Party Radio website, piratepartyradio.com, and fill out the feedback form. Let's head over to the news. In pirate news, UK pirates allowed to vote in costumes. I thought I'd start the show with a little bit of light news before we get into the heavy stuff. The general election is dominating the news in Britain today, which is actually today. It should be wrapping up about 3 hours ago, 2 p.m. my time. The general election is dominating the news in Britain today. Westminster Council's Nigel Tonkin, who's been organizing elections for 35 years, has been commenting to the BBC on the do's and don'ts at the polling station. He confirmed that party insignia and emblems are not allowed, but that Pirate Party voters are free to show up in a pirate costume. There's a candidate standing in Westminster as a pirate, and if he comes to vote in a pirate costume, it is likely we won't turn him away. Same goes for any supporters coming to vote as pirates. Parrots and other pets are also welcome at the polling stations, Tonkin said. In all seriousness, the UK Pirate Party is no joke. They stand for real issues that are dear to the hearts of voters but are often overlooked by other politicians. The passing of the Digital Economy Act is a prime example of where the public opinion differs from that of the lawmakers. As with the Swedish Party in the last summer's EU elections, not all the candidates are fresh-faced youngsters. Quite a few are definitely middle-aged, including party leader Andrew Robinson, 41, who's confident that his party can make a difference if given the chance. Today, we can strike fear into the hearts of our enemies, Andrew Robinson said. Today, we can show them that we'll no longer sit idly, but by as they take our rights away. As they take away our privacy, as they force greater and greater burdens and costs on us while lining their own pockets. Today, we can show them what can be achieved by real men and women scattered across the country, connected by technologies. The other parties still struggle to understand, Robinson added. The polling stations will close 10 p.m. local time. The first results are expected to come in later in the evening. Pirate Party candidates are Andrew Robinson, Worcester, Graham Lambert, Bury North, Alexander von Tetteren. Well, I won't read them out because the elections have already been over by the time you have heard this, and actually the results should be coming in. Copyright news from the U.S. Courts okay unmasking identities of copyright scofflaws. Sent in by Mind Inversion. A federal appeals court is blessing the legal process by which the recording industry and other content owners unmask the identities of alleged peer-to-peer copyright infringers. The decision by the second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals is believed to be the first appellate court to sanction a process that has ultimately hauled tens of thousands of alleged peer-to-peer infringers into courts, many at the request of the RIAA. They have upheld the RIAA's legal strategy, said Richard A. Altman, the New York attorney who brought the court challenge. Thursday's decision comes as indie filmmakers are using the same process to acquire the identities of thousands of BitTorrent users accused of copyright infringement. The legal action was brought by a State University of New York at Albany student accused of using Nutella to download and make songs available on the internet. The RIAA detected what it claimed to be infringing activity on an IP address the university linked to the student. The unidentified student moved to quash a federal judge's order that the university forward the student's identity to the RIAA. The student asserted First Amendment right to privacy on the internet, in addition to fair use right to the six music tracks in question. The appeals court ruled in the RIAA's favor after balancing a constitutional right to remain anonymous against a copyright owner's right to disclose the identity of a possible trespasser of its intellectual property interest. To the extent that anonymity is used to mask copyright infringement or to facilitate such infringement by other persons is unprotected by the First Amendment, the appeals court wrote. And even if the defendant claims a fair use right to the material in question, content owners have a right to learn the identities to commence a lawsuit, the court wrote. That's the troubling part I find about this, is that now copyright owners can force to reveal the identity of people who are using copyrighted information in fair use. So you can't get away anymore in the U.S., by using small clips of copyrighted material in non-commercial use. It's gone. This court ruled that you cannot hide behind anonymity even if you use tiny clips of a copyrighted material. So you can be outed by using a small clip of copyrighted material, even in a political statement, an ironic statement, a parody statement. It's no longer protected. You will be turned in by your ISP. Copyright news from the U.S. again. Songwriters Guild claims the internet makes it impossible to create content. sent in by Minded Version. Last Friday, we highlighted that the White House had posted the public comments on the IP enforcement plan and pointed out a few of them. We had avoided the ones from most of the well-known lobbying groups because they tread on ground that had been trampled to death. But a bunch of you had been submitting the filing from Songwriters Guild of America, which takes the ridiculous arguments to entirely new levels. Philip pointed us to Ars Technica's take on the comment, highlighting the utterly ridiculous claim that bank robbery is less of an issue than copyright infringement. But the rest of the filing also raises some bizarre arguments as well. Of course, the SGA and its boss, Rick Karns, are sort of famous for their over-the-top ridiculous claims that were debunked ages ago. But Karns never seems to let up. In Karns' world, the government owes songwriters a living. And the fact that the market has changed is no concern to him, because he doesn't want to change, and the government should do everything possible to stop such market changes. Karns slash SGA also have said that network neutrality means more piracy, that songwriters cannot write without copyright, and my favorite, that no technological change should ever be allowed to decrease royalties for songwriters. So what's in the filing? Let's start at the beginning. The current internet delivery system is not tenable for creators and copyright owners. Yes, you read that right. The current internet, perhaps the greatest tool for content creation ever, is not a tenable delivery system for content creators. Of course, that's easily debunked because more content is being created today thanks to the internet and the fact that it's a very efficient delivery system. The fact that thousands upon thousands of content creators have embraced the internet, used it to help create, promote, distribute, and share their music, and as a way to build better, more efficient business models, according to Karns and the SGA, that's not tenable. Weird, somebody alert everyone else on the internet. Digital piracy has almost completely destroyed the profession of songwriting and is slowly destroying the music industry. And yet more songs are being produced and released every year than ever before, and more money is being put in the music industry than ever before. That's a funny definition of destroyed and destroying. Of course, the crux of the Guild's argument is basically that the music publishers no longer employ songwriters. Yes, and the phone companies don't employ as many operators as they used to. Times change, technology change, get used to it. Copyright law is not a law to require that there be a specific profession for songwriters. Copyright law is designated to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. That's how it's designated in the Constitution. Or not the Constitution, but the original copyright law that was enacted in the U.S., those specific words. And if more music is being created than ever before, it appears that progress is being promoted, even if the profession of songwriting changes. But why let facts get in the way that the claim that unauthorized file sharing will destroy the U.S. economy? Such piracy has deeply and materially harmed the songwriters' community, but it also threatens, these are quotes, but also threatens the overall U.S. economy. And the economic fate of the U.S. copyright industries is critical to the U.S. economic success both domestically and in the global marketplace. Of course, he cites the already debunked claims of how much the copyright industries contribute to the U.S. economy, totally ignoring the counter-study that shows the exceptions to the copyright law contribute much more to the economy by using the very same methodology as the study SGA cites. So why let facts get in the way of a good rant about how the internet is destroying the music industry? Well, you know what? It is destroying the music industry, and I'm glad to see it go in its current form, and it opens up to the general population, not just those special artists sitting up top on a pedestal being financed by the record companies. I'd rather see it in the hands of millions of people than in the hands of the top 10 artists that are dictated to you every week. In copyright news from the U.S., Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, All Pirates, a strange title, but sent in by Platon. Copyright is a double-edged sword, and those who sharpen one side often get cut by the other. 2 weeks ago, we reported that the gadget blog Gizmodo was going after bloggers who copied their work without permission, while they were stealing from photographers themselves. Now, one of the photographers have written in again, pointing us to a photo gallery of this Icelandic volcano eruption last month that was published on Fox News. Like Gizmodo, Fox News is also exploiting the work of Flickr user Orvatli without permission. This clearly violates his copyrights, and Orvar is not pleased to say the least. This was a once-in-a-lifetime photo session for me, and these big media companies are ruining the value of my images by publishing them. Each time the image gets published, their value decreases, Ovar told Torrent Freak. Publishers generally want unique and unpublished images on their media, so a rarely or unpublished image has a higher value than those everyone has seen, he said. He added, as with Gizmodo, Ovar sent an invoice to Fox News to get paid for his work. Although Gizmodo eventually paid half of his standard fee after he kept complaining, Fox News is not responding to his inquiries at all. Fox News is obviously not living up to its fair and balanced tagline. Now, we probably wouldn't have covered this issue if Fox News wasn't owned by Rupert Murdoch. The multimedia tycoon is known copyright evangelist who accuses Google and other search engines of copyright infringement for indexing the website of his newspapers. Murdoch's News Corp is outfit also owns the film studio 20th Century Fox, an MPAA member that has launched several lawsuits against torrent sites, including the Pirate Bay. It seems that Murdoch has a double standard when it comes to copyright infringement. Apparently, it's not that bad if he's the one making the money from it. Well, there's the lesson is in the last line. It's who's making the money and who has the most money to fight against the other person in a court of law. Because it's really the courts that are deciding what's moral, what's just, and what's right. So if you have the most money, you can ignore the law, or ignore what the law says, at least, until you take you to court. But if you have the most money, there you're never inevitably going to win the court. Not by decision, but by just monetary amount alone, being able to throw the most lawyers at the case and be able to drown the other person out. In worldwide patent news, why are civilizations, video art, and culture is threatened by the MPEG LA? Sent in by Platon, we've all heard how the H.264 is rolled over on patents and royalties. Even with these facts, I kept supporting the best performing delivery codec on the market, which is H.264. Let the best win, I kept thinking, but it wasn't until very recently when I was made aware this problem is way deeper. No, my friends, it's not just a matter of picking Theora to export a video to YouTube and be clear of any litigation. MPEG LA's trick runs way deeper. The people at MPEG LA have made sure that from the moment we use a camera or camcorder to shoot an MPEG 2 or H.264 video, which includes almost the full line of cameras out this today, we owe them royalties, even if the final video distributor was not encoded using their codecs. Let me show you how deep the rabbit hole goes. You see, there's something very important that the vast majority of both consumers and video professionals don't know. All modern video cameras and camcorders that shoot in H.264 or MPEG-2 come with a license agreement that says that you can only use the camera to shoot video for personal use and non-commercial purposes. Go on, read your manual. Yes. If I was first made aware of such a restriction when somebody mentioned that in a forum about the Canon 7D DSLR, I thought it didn't apply to me. But since I bought the double the price professional, at least prosumer, Canon 5D Mark II, but looking at its licensing agreement last night on page 241, I found that even my $3,000 camera comes such with a basic license. So I downloaded the manual for the Canon 1D Mark IV, a camera that costs $5,000, where Canon consistently used the word professional and video in the same sentence as their press release for the camera. Nope, same restriction. You can only use your professional video DSLR camera, professional according to Canon's press release, for non-professional reasons. And going even further, I found that even their truly professional video camera, the $8,000 Canon XL-H1A that uses MPEG-2, comes with a similar restriction. You can only use your professional camera for non-commercial purposes. For any other purposes, you must get a license from MPEG-LA and pay them royalties for each copy sold. I personally find this utterly unacceptable. Now, this is amazing because some of my stuff that I produce in video is shot on Canon's camera, so I fall under this restriction as well. Whether they're going to take you to court and use this in court, it's more like a whim law that they're throwing in that they could use it if maybe you're doing something weird with their camera. Who knows what they're going to use that for and why they would throw that in? It's just something that they can get away with, then, because they can write it down, and who's going to take them to task for that? And I've always wondered, say you're a musician as well, and you use a keyboard or a guitar or a certain instrument to make your music. Why haven't the makers of these instruments gone after musicians for royalties? It's like, you use our sample from our keyboard or our guitar sound, our pickups made your album. We want a cut of your album, because they know that's not in their best interest to do that. They should be promoting the use of Canon cameras, not restricting the non-professionals from using them and saying you can't make any money off of them. They should be promoting them. Or maybe they're trying to push the more expensive cameras. Well, you have to pay a license unless you pay the exorbitant amount of even over $8,000, because they're saying $8,000 still has this restriction. So you have to pay, you know, $10,000 at least to get escape from the grasps of our non-commercial license that you've agreed to by opening up this camera. It's just astounding what they're trying to suppress in the in the common market for people that are just regular everyday Joes like you and me, trying to do our own thing. Imagine if this microphone that I was talking into had put a digital watermark on the recording, and they could detect that, saying that you owe us money for doing your show because you used our microphone, and we can tell we've decoded the watermark in it. You've used our mixing board, our sound card, our computer to record this. It could go down the line, and saying that applies to a video camera is just as ridiculous as saying it applies to a sound card, a mixing board, a microphone, or even a computer, because the data went through it and you use that computer to make your commercial media. Utterly ridiculous what they're trying to get away with nowadays. Privacy news from the U.S. Facebook's eroding privacy policy and timeline. Yes, I've harped over and over again on Facebook over and over during the weeks of this show. But this one lays it on the line of the progression of Facebook's privacy policy. And it's from EFF.org, sent in by DC. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. You should go to the timeline and read the rest. Since its incorporation just over 5 years ago, Facebook has undergone a remarkable transformation. When it started, it was a private space for communication with a group of your choice. Soon, it transformed into a platform where much of your information is public by default. Today, it has become a platform where you have no choice but to make certain information public. And this public information may be shared by Facebook with its partner sites and used to target ads. To help illustrate Facebook's shift away from privacy, we have highlighted some excerpts from Facebook's privacy policies over the year. Watch closely as your privacy disappears, one small change at a time. And this one, first one's from 2005. No personal information that you submit to Facebook will be used to any user of the website who does not belong to at least one group specified by you in your privacy settings. Because you used to belong to groups. Like, if you were in Vancouver, you'd belong to the Vancouver group. If you were in New York, you belong to the New York group. And that's only who you would be sharing it with. Or you belong to a company or even a group of friends. And then 2006, we understand that you may not want to give everyone in the world to have information you share on Facebook. That's why we give you control of your information. Our default privacy settings limit the information displayed in your profile to your school, your specified local area, and other reasonable community limitations that we tell about. And fast forward, of course, to 2010. There's lots more in between. You can read it on the page. When you connect with an application or website, it will have access to general information about you. The term general information includes your and your friends' names, profile pictures, gender, user IDs, connections, and any content shared using the Everyone privacy setting. The default privacy setting for certain types of information you post on Facebook is set to everyone. Because it takes two to connect, your privacy settings only control who can see the connection on your profile page. If you're uncomfortable with the connection being publicly available, you should consider removing or not making the connection. Viewed together, the successive policies tell a clear story. Facebook originally earned its core base of users by offering them a simple and powerful controls over the personal information. As Facebook grew larger, it became more important. It could have chosen to maintain or improve these controls. Instead, it slowly but surely helped itself itself and its advertising and business partners to more and more of its users' information while limiting the users' options to control their own information. And I also provide a link to top 10 reasons you should quit Facebook. That was on from Gizmodo. Copyright news from Canada. Canadians drop gloves and punch U.S. in face over piracy list. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Once again, Canada appears near the top of the U.S. government's 2010 Special 301 Piracy Watch List. And once again, the Canadians are angry about being classed with China and Russia as the worst places on earth for intellectual property law. Michael Geist, a prominent Canadian academic at the University of Ottawa Law School, slams the report for bullying and being long on rhetoric but short on facts. According to Geist, Canada's reputation as a piracy haven simply isn't accurate. According to the software industry's own piracy numbers, Canada's software piracy rate is declining and is dramatically lower than any other country on the priority watch list. Moreover, even the Business Software Alliance has characterized Canada as a low piracy country. According to the recording industry's own numbers, the Canadian recording industry did not decline last year as badly as the US or Japan, and it ranked well ahead of the global average for digital music sales growth. According to the motion picture industry, illegal camcording has declined rapidly in Canada in recent years. Canada is one of the only countries in the world with criminal convictions for such activities. Canada is often characterized as a prominent home for BitTorrent sites, yet there are more sites hosted in European countries such as the Netherlands not included on the list. Canada is the only participant in the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement to be named on the priority watch list. Apparently, our involvement in those talks count for little. Canadian copyright lawyer Howard Knopf, also no fan of the Special 301 process, agrees that Canada gets a bad rap for bad reasons. In fact, he argues Canadian copyright law is much stronger than U.S. copyright law in at least 21 ways. Here are a few. Canada has a rich blank media levy scheme that has generated nearly $300 million overall to date, most of which will wind up in the USA. Artists see at most about an average of $160 per year of this, and probably much less in reality on average basis. The US has never had anything comparable. Canada has no parity right exception for creators and users. In fact, the Canadian federal court has explicitly ruled against such a right. On the other hand, U.S. Supreme Court has confirmed such a right. Canada has no time-shifting exception that would clearly allow for illegal use of DVRs, PVRs, such as TiVo in Canada. The U.S. has had this right since the 1984 Betamax decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Recent U.S. jurisprudence in the Cablevision case have extended this user right and this technology into the cloud. Canada has crown copyright, which leads to all kinds of unnecessary costs and complications for those ranging from advanced researchers to fishermen, who should be able to depend on mapping and GPS information for life-saving purposes from the government and not privatized for profit parties. Canada privatized its government copyright for profit, which cannot happen in the U.S. As for the whole premise of the Special 301 report, people like Geist have been railing against it for years. The 2007 paper, Geist argued that the process is merely political and is driven by special interests. If it had a real basis in international law, the annual report would look quite different. And I guess as a retort back to that, the Canadian government, this is coming from them, copyright news from Canada, PMO issues the order, Canadian DMCA bill within 6 weeks. Sent in by Mind Inversion. Months of public debate over the future of Canadian copyright law were quietly decided earlier this week when sources say the Prime Minister's office reached a verdict over the direction of the next copyright bill. The PMO was forced to make the call after Canadian Heritage Minister James Moore and Industry Minister Tony Clement were unable to reach consensus over the broad framework of a new bill. As I reported last week, Moore has argued for a virtual repeat of Bill C-61, with strong digital locks provisions similar to those found in the U.S. Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and a rejection of flexible, fair-dealing approach. Consistent with earlier comments on the need for a forward-looking, flexible approach, Clement argued for changes from C-61. With mounting pressure from the U.S., there have been repeated meetings with senior U.S. officials in recent weeks. The PMO sided squarely with Moore's vision of a U.S.-style copyright law. The detailed provisions will be negotiated over the coming weeks by their respective departments, but now they have marching orders of completing a bill that will satisfy the U.S. that comes complete with the tough anti-circumvention rules and no flexible fair dealing provisions. The bill is not expected until June, but it will have dramatic repercussions once introduced. First, this bill represents a stunning reversal from the government's seeming shift away from C-61 and its commitment to a bill based on the national copyright consultation. Instead, the consultation appears to have little more than theater, with PMO and Moore choosing to dismiss public opinion. Second, after adopting distinctly pro-consumer positions on other issues, Moore has abandoned that approach with support from what may become the most anti-consumer copyright bill in Canadian history. Third, the bill will immediately impact Canadian position at the ACTA and CETA negotiations, where the bill's provision on anti-circumvention and ISP liability will effectively become Canadian delegation position. For those of you wondering what could be done, my only answer is to speak out now. Write a paper letter to your Member of Parliament and send copies to Prime Minister Moore, Clement, and Liberal leader Michael Inagtiev. No stamp is required. Be sure to include your home address and send it to House of Commons, Ottawa, Ontario, K1A0A6. Once that is done, join the Facebook group and the Facebook page and make sure others to do the same. You have spoken out before, but your voice is needed again. So we're going to be watching what's going to be coming down the pipeline from the Canadian government in terms of a DMCA-style bill coming to Canada. That was from Michael Geis-Page, and I'm sure he'll be updating as soon as the wording of the bill comes out so we can take an approach to the bill and be able to tell our leaders what we do not want being enacted in Canada to follow what has happened in the U.S. with people being able to do what they want with their own equipment, being able to time shift things for like a DVD to a different kind of type of format, be able to do whatever you want with your equipment and not have ridiculous restrictions placed upon hardware that you own. Privacy news from Canada. Canadians to get e-passports in 2011, but security experts voice concerns, sent in by Semaphore. As early as next year, Canadians who apply for passports will receive documents with chips that contain their digital images and personal information such as name, gender, and a date and a place of birth. Passport Canada says the new e-passports will increase security, provide greater protection against tampering, and reduce the risk of fraud. But they've also raised the concerns about privacy, identity theft, misidentification, and the growth of government surveillance of citizens. I am not reassured that the passport office has adequately addressed of the many concerns, said Andrew Clement, professor of faculty information at the University of Toronto. Full assurance, he said, would require a thorough expert and independent assessment with public reporting of all but the necessary confidential aspects. As far as I know, nothing close to this has been done. The plan to introduce e-passports in 2011, valid for 10 years instead of a current 5, was announced in the 2008 budget and re-announced in the throne speech this month. Though the 70% of Canadians have passports, 82% are unaware that the electronic documents are imminent, according to a survey done for Passport Canada. I did not know this till this report came out. That could soon change. Within the next couple of weeks, Passport Canada will begin a major online consultation with Canadians, spokesman Jean Sebastian Roy said Tuesday. After the results have been analyzed, the agency will consult Canadians again, this time focusing on the introduction of the new e-passport. Only then will its cost and date of implementation be set, said Roy. It's even conceivable its introduction could be delayed in 2012. Roy said everything depends on the consultation. Still, Passport Canada is keen to proceed. More than 60 countries have e-passports, including every member of the G7 except Canada. The transition to the e-passport will have a certain cost, Roy acknowledged, but the cost of falling behind other countries is much greater. Under a pilot project that started in January 2009, Passport Canada has already issued 25,000 diplomatic and special e-passports. So far, no difficulties have been reported. To address concern raised by the Federal Privacy Commissioner, Passport Canada backed away last year from introducing fingerprints and iris scans in the e-passport. Well, we continue to be very interested in this issue, said Anne-Marie Hayden, spokeswoman for the commissioner. The commissioner's office expects to receive an update on the national rollout of the e-passports in the next few weeks, she said. We plan to look at the report very carefully to determine whether or not we have any outstanding concerns or questions from a privacy perspective. As it stands, the only biometric element on the proximity contactless chip embedded in the e-passports will be the holder's photo. That will let the border authorities use facial recognition technology to compare the photo on the chip to watch lists of known terrorists and criminals. Passport Canada touts this as a security enhancement, but facial recognition technology isn't accurate enough to be used for a one-to-many matching. There will be a higher number of wrongful matches, which could be inconveniencing or worse for the people involved, he added. The passport office should provide some real evidence that it would work. Another concern is the unauthorized individuals could surreptitiously skim personal information for fraudulent use or overwrite chips with another person's data. But according to Passport Canada, it's extremely unlikely that data stored on the chip could be read without the knowledge of the passport holder. Scanners will only be able to read the chip in e-passports from a distance of 10 centimeters or less. It's not like those enhanced driver's license, Roy said. Moreover, data on the chip cannot be accessed unless the machine-readable area on the passport's second page has first been read, meaning the passport book must be open. That's an interesting statement. The agency argues e-passports add more layers of identity checks, all of which must pass. Now, I'm not so sure about that the data on the chip can't be accessed unless the second page has been read. How does the chip know that some other machine has read a page on your book, a physical paper page? People skimming data, passing by you within 10 centimeters, bumping into you, stealing your data, their readers don't know that they've read the second page. Neither does the chip. Once this data has been broken on the passports, your data is floating out in the internet and you're not able to get it back. That's the problem with storing biometric data on a chip or on somewhere outside of your body, is once it's in the wild, that's it. It's over. You can't change your own DNA. You can't change your own iris. You can't change the look of your face. Unless you go under extreme surgery, but the iris and the DNA is not going to be changed. So once your data is out in the wild, it's over for you. You have been compromised yourself. It's not like a passport on an email address. You can change your password. Did I say passport? You can change your password, but you cannot change your biometric data on yourself. So allowing your biometric data to be encoded onto something that can be stolen by somebody bumping into you and passing by you with an RFID reader is the wrong approach to security. You should be able to keep this data within yourself and only be able to be read by actually putting maybe your fingerprint on a fingerprint scanner, not encoding your fingerprint into some database where it can be compromised forever and ever and ever. And then it's all over. You're not yourself anymore, and you're going to be questioned every turn. You're going to be flagged down every time you take a ride on a plane, every time you leave the country, you go across the border, anytime you want anything that's of an official stature, you're going to be questioned and taken into a room for 10 minutes, and it's going to be hell on earth for the rest of your life. And this is the wrong approach to take to security. And further to that, the public e-passport consultation ends tomorrow. So this is the first time I have heard about this, and I run a radio show on security and privacy. What is the chance that the rest of the public is going to be knowing about this when the consultation ends tomorrow, Friday, May 7th? So if you're Canadian and you're listening to this, please go to the website that I've provided in the Pirate Radio forums, Power Party Radio forums, and please send them a letter with your concerns about your biometric privacy that you're never going to be able to retain once it leaks out into the wild. Now, privacy news from the U.S. Photocopier fallout. Company notifies 409,000 of data breach. Sent in by Random Hero. When Armin Kiatienne first reported a story on digital copiers and their hard drives on April 19th, there were no known cases of data breaches coming from copy machine hard drives. Now, I'd never heard about this before. I never even knew that there was hard drives inside photocopiers, and that clip off the top of the show was talking about this. So I'll read on. In an ironic twist, our story became the first publicly known case of a data breach from a copy machine hard drive when we purchased a copier that had been once owned by Affinity Health Plan. Because of medical privacy laws, Affinity was required then to file a breach of notification to state and federal regulators and notify all its clients and everyone who might have ever had information on Affinity copy machines, including current and former employees. They sent out a breach notification on April 5th saying that the company had been told of the hard drive problem on March 17th, the day they were first contacted by CBS News. Affinity told 409,000 individuals that their personal or medical data may have been compromised, according to a filing with the New York State Consumer Protection Board. Medical records for 9 individuals were found on the digital copier that we purchased in a wholesale warehouse. The copier had once been in use in the Affinity headquarters in the Bronx. On the same copier, we found hundreds of pages of non-medical documents, including driver's licenses, social security cards, W-2 forms, and even a handwritten love note. CBS News returned the hard drives in a sealed envelope to a representative of Affinity on April 8th. Now, for those that don't know about the photocopier news story, that you could walk it, I don't know if it's possible anymore because they probably locked it down, but before this news story broke a couple weeks ago, you could walk into a used photocopier store, digital photocopier store, and pick up the photocopiers for however much they're selling them for, take the hard drive out of the digital photocopier, hook it up to a computer, and retrieve all the documents that had ever been scanned on that photocopier that were retained in the hard drive, and decode them and print them out. Hundreds of thousands of pages of documents from banks, from health insurance companies, from wherever they're being used, because there is not enough knowledge out there about the privacy breach that could happen if these hard drives were not wiped. There is just not enough focus placed upon privacy in this country with corporate information taken on the public. And this is another example of just the ignorance of what's going on out there. It's astounding that this kind of privacy breaches keep happening over and over again, and there's no oversight on data privacy to an extent that people are protected, where data can be collected surreptitiously almost. I mean, I watched the short clip on the show, and they do put warnings in the photocopier book, but my question is why? Why is this data stored for any length of time? Why is hundreds of thousands of pages from years ago being stored on a photocopier? Why does that need to be stored longer than even 24 hours? You've photocopied the page, you're done with it, it should delete it. I can understand being a need for it to say, oh, I wanted 5 copies instead of 4, and not having to put the page down again. But, I mean, geez, years later, that's ridiculous and not necessary. And this is a complete breach of privacy and should not be allowed to be able to retain that data for that length of time. And that should apply to every kind of thing to deal with public information. There should be stronger privacy laws enacted, and these kind of things held up as perfect examples of privacy problems. This could apply to web pages, this could apply to photocopiers, this could apply to any corporation or government organization that does not need to retain your information, personal information, for any length of time. Once you're done with that information, it should be erased securely to never be able to be retrieved again, with military-grade deletion techniques. Now, privacy news from the U.S. Major internet privacy legislation was unveiled today. Here we go. I called for it, and here it is. By Representative Rick Boucher and Representative Cliff Stearns. Under the bill, companies would be forbidden from using your cell phone's geolocation information without your consent. And the same goes for information on your race, religious beliefs, or sexual orientation. For most other information, a simple opt-out will keep that data, even data already collected, from being used. Boucher chairs the House Subcommittee on Communications, Technology, and the Internet, and he has dealt with internet issues for years. He was a driving force behind the doomed attempt to patch the worst parts of the DMCA as well. Stearns is the ranking member on the committee. The two released discussion draft on the new privacy legislation in order to gauge congressional and public opinion on its ideas. The bill isn't particularly long, and compared to laws in other countries, it's not particularly strict. But it does provide a decent privacy baseline in the U.S., providing limited protection for covered information, and a much tougher protection for sensitive information. The bill makes a key distinction between two kinds of data. Covered information collection is opt-out, while sensitive information collection would be opt-in only. According to the bill, covered information includes the first name or initial and last name, a postal address, telephone or fax number, an email address, unique biometric data, including a fingerprint or retina scan, social security number, tax identification number, passport number, driver's license number, any government-issued identification number, a financial account number or credit card or debit number, card number, and any required security code, access code, or password that is necessary to permit access to an individual financial account. Any unique persistent identifier such as a customer number, unique pseudonym or user alias, internet protocol address, other unique identifiers, whereas identifiers used to collect, store, or identify information about a specific individual or computer. And if this is the covered information. They don't really differentiate right here, which is opt-out or opt-in only. I go on. Companies and websites that disclose their data collection practices can harvest this data on the assumption that by using the site, one has agreed to such collection, but they're required to provide an opt-out option that will stop all data collection and prevent the company from using even previously acquired data. Sensitive information can't even be collected and stored in the first place without an explicit opt-in assent. The bill identifies sensitive information such as, so you have to opt in for people to record this list. The other one is an opt out. This one's an opt in. Medical records including medical history, mental or physical condition, or medical treatment or diagnosis by a healthcare profession. So that would cover this photocopier incident that has happened recently. You would have to opt in for them to store your medical information, and storage would be defined as a hard drive on a photocopier. I continue. Race or ethnicity, religious beliefs, sexual orientation, financial records or other financial information associated with financial account, including balances and other financial information, precise geolocation information. So that's a very good list for opt-in, because that could be used against you for people who have prejudices or people who are trying to judge you in terms of information that you can't change at all. Of course, the other stuff you can change, like your first name and last name, your address, you can move, you can get a new telephone number, you can get a new email address. The other one, biometric data, you can't change that. So, but this is just being proposed. When it comes to the last one, the bill states that users expressed opt-in consent to an application provider that relies on a platform offered by a commercial mobile service provider shall satisfy the requirements of this subsection. So I think this is only applying to cell phones, unfortunately. This would be better if it was, you know, spread out a little bit more to more companies than just cell phones, because I missed the name of the article here. Religion, sex, money, location, bill makes them sensitive. Let me just go and get the name of this article, but I believe, because it doesn't tell you really in the article what this is for. I think this is only for cell phones. So this should be really more wide-reaching, because this sounds like a good start for privacy in the U.S. or anywhere, that, for a matter of fact. Net neutrality news from the U.S. FCC to make move on net neutrality. The FCC will announce on Thursday that it still plans to pursue tough net neutrality rules, opening a new front in an ongoing legal battle that could come to define the commission under Chairman Julius Genachowski. A senior FCC official said Wednesday that the chairman will seek to restore the status quo as it existed before a federal court stripped the commission of the authority to regulate broadband providers and set rules that mandate open internet. The goal is to fulfill a previously stated agenda of extending broadband to all America, protecting consumers, ensuring fair competition, and preserving a free and open internet, the FCC official said. While details of Thursday's announcement are scant, Genachowski's third way approach would seem skirt some of the debate over reclassification. The rulemaking process that could allow FCC to institute tough net neutrality rules and implement challenging sections of its national broadband plan, but would also prompt quick legal challenges from broadband providers and telecommunication companies. A federal court ruled last month that the FCC only had jurisdiction of Title II, or telecommunication services, while broadband actually fell under Title I, or information services. Rather than simply taking broadband and redesignating it as a telecommunication service, the commission would use a procedure called forbearance to pick and choose elements of Title II to apply to broadband providers. Some of the provisions the FCC plans to apply, which an official did not specified to Hillcon Valley on Wednesday, would likely allow agency to continue pursuing the net neutrality rules both Jenikowski and President Barack Obama have long touted. However, broadband and telecommunications company are still likely to fight the FCC's move, even though its Title II light approach imposes far fewer regulations on them than reclassification. Comcast and Verizon were not immediately available for comment on Wednesday, though Verizon has in the past threatened to challenge any effort to regulate broadband in court. AT&T later declined to remark the court's commission's latest move. Still, the announcement is sure to satisfy net neutrality proponents who balked at earlier news this week that the FCC might punt the issue to Congress. So, this is very good news, but we still have to wait to see what is going to be outlined in their proposition. Now, it's very strange that they don't classify the internet providers as telecommunication services, because a lot of internet providers provide almost everything over their either phone lines or cable lines. They provide telephone, they provide television, they provide internet, just about anything, because it's all data. And yet the telephone companies are regulated. So they provide telephone plus more. It's a very strange way to approach it. But, you know, whoever has the most money wins, and the people running these broadband companies have a lot of money to throw around. Now, copyright news from the U.S. is the day we've been waiting for, and we knew it would come, but we didn't know when. Google goes on offensive and sues record label over copyright, sent in by DC. So Google is throwing its hat in the legal ring. Google has taken the rare step of asking a California judge to declare that by linking to copyright-infringing works in RapidShare, the search giant is not facilitating the illegal distribution of copyrighted songs. Last year, Blue Destiny Records, a small blues-oriented music label, sued Google, Microsoft, and RapidShare in Florida. The label claimed that RapidShare was running a distribution center for unlawful copies of copyrighted works, and that Google and Microsoft's Bing engine search were helping to prop up the company. The label argued that users can easily find copyrighted songs on file hosting websites by doing a simple search query. But in late March, Blue Destiny voluntarily withdrew its lawsuit. Google then asked the company to waive the right to pursue its copyright allegations. According to Google, the label refused, preserving its option to refile its claims. Now Google has decided it wants the court battle. The company has filed this 96-page complaint with the California District Court, asking for declaratory judgment that it's not infringing on Blue Destiny's copyrights. Google is showing a bit of hubris in its latest move. By going on the offensive, Google gets to do battle with a much smaller company in the inevitable fight over whether search engines facilitate copyright infringement. Plus, Google gets more favorable jurisdiction than a Florida court. The Ninth Circuit has been friendly to Google in similar litigation with Perfect Ten, an adult entertainment publisher who tried to punish search engines for indexing copyrighted photos. The decision in the forthcoming Blue Destiny trial, if it gets there, could mean a lot to both copyright owners and Google. If Google could win this case and get favorable treatment on appeal, it could go a long way towards clearing a big chunk of its potential copyright liability. And I would put that even one step further, that it would put forward a separation between the person who actually has the content and the person indexing the content or pointing to the content, which would also include in that definition torrent search engine sites, because they do not have the actual data. They just have pointers to the data, which the data is then stored on the people who are uploading and downloading the content itself. So this is a very good step in the direction of freedom of flow of information and not punishing the messenger, rather going after the person who is actually has the data on themselves, rather than going down and shutting down all the people who just are pointing to things. And I remember a story last week about going after somebody who was pointing to another page, and it's just a ridiculous argument that the person who's just saying go over here, they have something you might want, or that page has something, and maybe it's not, it's copyright infringing. I don't know. I don't have the data. I'm just telling you about it. So it's a very interesting move by Google. And I know we've been waiting for that day, and it has finally come. So we're going to keep our eyes on that court case against Blue Destiny Records. In Pirate Party news, this was an email from Andrew Robinson of the Pirate Party UK. Dear Pirates, today there is an election. Today we can strike fears into the hearts of our enemies. I quoted a bit earlier, but this is the full one. Today we can show them that we'll no longer sit idly by as they take away our rights, as they take away our privacy, as they force greater and greater burdens and costs on us while lining their own pockets. Today we can show them what could be achieved by real men and women scattered across the country, connected by technologies the other parties still struggle to understand. For the pirates, more than any other party, every single vote counts. It does not make much difference if Labour, Conservative, Liberal Democrats win or lose by 5,000 votes or 5,001. But adding just one vote to the pirates will really make a difference. Every extra fraction of a percentage that we get is a fraction of a percentage more parliamentary influence that we have over the next few years. This is the first and only chance some of you may get to vote pirate for the next several years. The first and only chance you will have to show the other parties that by ignoring our issues, they are losing support. May your vote count. Make your vote count. Vote pirate. Our candidates have worked long and hard to give the public a real choice and to turn us from political newcomers into a real party with a real track record. Now it's time for you to play your part in making us a genuine political force by going into the voting booths and making your mark on a piece of paper and making your mark on the political landscape. Our campaign doesn't end today, it starts today, because that's the day when we become an experienced, established political party. If you're lucky enough to have a local pirate candidate, today you can give us the power and influence we need for the future. Be proud to be a pirate. Pirate Party UK. And also, for Pirate Party of Canada, the next online meeting is May 19th, 2010 at 2000 hours Eastern Standard Time. Check out their website and forums for additional information, how to get into the IRC to be part of that meeting. And closing track here is called Know Your Meme, Challenging a YouTube Takedown with Fair Use. And it's from, I don't know if you've ever heard Know Your Meme, but it's kind of a tongue-in-cheek talking about memes. But because they do talk about memes, some of these memes are, well, everything's copyrighted works, but they to talk about the memes, they have to take somebody else's video and put it on their channel. But they have to invoke fair use, which it is, because they're just using a clip and explaining about it, using for educational use. So they have to defend themselves a lot of the time against things like the takedown of, takedown. Not takedown, what is it? The video of Hitler that was taken off the internet en masse. A lot of them have come back up now because they have claimed fair use and, you know, YouTube's putting them back up. But en masse, they were shut down by the company that owned that video. And they're using it for parody use, which is protected in the U.S. So, and also the EFF, I've got a link to the EFF that also has a guide to YouTube removal. So if your video that you put up that constitutes fair use or parody or something that is protected under law, you can challenge it, get your video back up. Really, it shouldn't be shut down in the first place, but that's the political process that you have to go, or the process that you have to go through with videos. That was sent in by DC. So remember, if any of these stories have interested you, please check out your local Pirate Party to find out more about what you can do to help preserve your rights and freedoms. So if you have any news stories you'd like to hear in the show, Questions or comments, just head over to piratepartyradio.com and submit them through the form on the website. So thank you for listening, and until next time, this has been James O'Brien for Pirate Party Radio.
Each day, hundreds of videos are falling victim to an ever-growing threat, wrongful copyright claim. These videos, which represent not only our common culture, but our very means of communication, are being taken down, silencing the voices of content creators and video remixers everywhere. But there is something you can do. Fair use is a legal defense that keeps copyright law from violating your First Amendment right to freedom of speech. According to U.S. copyright law, reproduction of a particular work may be considered fair, such as criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, and research. If you take someone else's existing video and just put it up online as is, you're infringing on their copyright, because you're circumventing the video's original market purpose. But when you create a new work that samples the original video, it transforms the original clip into something new. By disputing a wrongful copyright claim on the grounds of fair use, you too can save a video that might not otherwise have a choice.